Hey, I heard this was Frank Pratt.
Jesus Christ, is this Frank Pratt?
My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle. You might be listening to Art on Air at Art International Radio or possibly at frankprattle.com. I really don't know where you came from, but I do care. And my special guests today are Stephen Day and Ari Jankelowitz.
Thank you.
I believe I pronounced that right.
It's true.
It's one in a million.
I'm the only Ari Jankelowitz in the world.
Forever.
That I know of. That's true.
So tell me a little bit about who you guys are and what it is that you're doing. Stephen, you want to start out?
Yeah, I'm an artist, and I'm working mainly in photography and video. And I'm interested a lot in mainly urban architecture and documenting kind of urban scenarios. And so Ari and I are both presenting some new work at the Miami Basel Art Fair.
Okay, and for those listening, if you can give a website for sure. Them to check out.
Yeah, so it's called vinylcontemporary.com is the site, and it's Ari's, let Ari talk.
Okay. Well, my name is Ari Jankelowitz, and I am the director of Vinyl Contemporary, and for those of you who want to check up on the internet, it's V-I-N-Y-L. Contemporary.
How do you spell contemporary?
.com. So it's contemporary. I double check every time I write it in an email or by hand as well.
And
so don't feel embarrassed.
I knew vinyl was old, but you know now.
Yeah.
Old. Actually, my dad asked me how to spell vinyl, and I was like, "Dad, that's vinyl." You know, Jesus.
And, you know, it's a catchy name, I guess.
Well, so yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. Vinyl Contemporary is a new gallery that yes. This is the spearhead moment of it. It's coming down in Art Basel, Miami,
right.
Which is happening next week, the beginning of December 09 in Miami.
December 3rd to the 6th. Yeah. And it's actually at the Verge Art Fair.
That's correct.
Oh, okay.
Because there's like a million fairs down there. And,
right.
And this is the first year of Verge. So
yes, it was originally a part of the Bridge Art Fair that has now spawned its own fair. So it's sort of just with emerging galleries at the Verge Art Fair.
Okay, so you know, for those listening in art fairs,
yeah.
you know where many galleries come together, and oftentimes with spectators as well,
mm-hmm.
They have it's huge, oftentimes like cubicle style, in a gymnasium or a large, you know, kind of open air sometimes even
or hotels too.
Hotel, yeah, art fair, and everybody sets up like a you know small partitions, and then has art inside. And so is it going to be something like that, or is it...
Actually, it's going to be a little bit more interesting. It's going to be in the Catalina Hotel.
Okay.
So each gallery or non-profit space, like Smack Melon will be there, and some various...
Max Protek as well.
Max Protek is presenting a non-profit space. They won't be selling work at the fair, but they'll be presenting an artist. I'm not sure who... exactly is going to be there for them.
Okay.
But, you know, so the various galleries from, and there's going to be some from all over the world, they get a room in the hotel, and we turn that into a gallery space, an installation. And so, you know, some people will play with the hotel room and keep the furniture. Other people will turn it into just like a standard gallery space where it'll just be the walls and no furniture inside and, yeah, it's
actually the bathroom becomes part of the exhibition space as
yes.
well.
So, yeah.
So I've been thinking about some ideas for that. But this show, often at fairs, the galleries bring down a bunch of different artists, but we wanted to do something different, which was to do just a kind of a solo show and show one body of work and just treat it like an exhibition. But if you think about that in terms of one hotel, there's 30 galleries or something on two floors, and if they're each gallery showing like multiple art, sometimes it's just too much, you know, it's like overload. So Sometimes just a sort of simpler, direct sort of presentation of the work is sometimes better.
So, yeah, tell me a little bit about what you're going to be showing. I mean, we have before us a kind of a cross sample of some of the things that you've been working on recently. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, I'm horrible at describing things, but I like some of these very much. And tell me, you know, your subject matter seems to be fairly varied.
Yeah.
You know, do you tend to go out in the street and shoot, or
right?
What's your method?
Right. Well, this I usually work in terms of projects, and I'm interested in a lot of housing projects. But this is really a different idea. This is titled Night and Day, and it's about a sort of encounters and unexpected sort of unplanned encounters, and the idea is I always have a camera with me when I'm traveling, and if I'm on the subway, or if I'm doing you know, meeting somebody, or even going doing a freelance job, and it's sort of those unplanned moments when you're not really expecting to see anything, and so it's about capturing that moment or documenting that moment, and actually. We actually had an encounter on the Bowery. We went to see the Breeders.
Yes, we did.
One night, and I ran into you, right? But literally 10 seconds after I saw you, we walked past this bus shelter on the Bowery, and there was this man there, a very old man. He didn't have a shirt on. And he was standing in front of this fluorescent, or sitting at the bus shelters, and he was sitting in front of this fluorescent light, and there was this beautiful light on him, and he was kind of hunched over, and he had this white hair, and he looked like, almost like an old eagle or something. It was really a compelling image, and I thought, and so I stopped, and my friend stopped, and I said, wait, and I walked back, and I thought, I have to photograph this man, you know. And at that moment, a woman saw him, and she pulled out a banana and gave it to him, which I thought was sort of... and so I was watching this, and then I photographed him with the banana. And anyway, so this photograph is in the show, but it's sort of interesting. But that's a kind of a scenario that... is a sort of unplanned encounter, but a lot of the pictures are taken in Brooklyn, in Bed-Stuy, and also in my neighborhood of Washington Heights.
And so, how long have you been shooting photographs? Now?
The Night and Day I started about 2 years ago, and it actually started with one particular image, and I was meeting with a friend of mine, Noemi, and she was showing a family picture. And she showed me a picture of her at a wedding when she was 25, and her sister was getting married. And she had a glass of wine in her hand, and she was wearing this black dress. And it was a kind of an image that just started to get me to think differently about photography. It was a very personal image. It was not... it was just a portrait, you know. And it had a really different kind of feel to it. And I started to think about doing a different body of work just based on looking at this one photograph. So.
And so, Ari, yourself, how long have you guys been collaborating together?
3 years now.
3 years?
Yeah, since we first worked together on a fashion shoot for a downtown guy...
Apollo.
Orchin. Apollo, yeah. Braun, if you're out there listening to us. He has since returned to the motherland of Israel. But, yeah, we started working in photography, and I started working with Steven. And basically over the time, we just started talking about a gallery. And it just sort of came to fruition right now.
Yeah. But yeah, and Ari assisted me on a couple projects too. When we were at PS1, he was also working over there.
Yeah.
When he had the show at the Emergency Room show. But and then we started. We did a project in the Bronx together.
Yeah.
We were shooting a lot of the parks.
That was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yep. I mean, One of the things about starting a gallery right at this moment, I mean, this is obviously something you guys have thought about, is that many people talk about the fact that the art market is going to shit, you know, like straight up. In fact, I had a good friend of mine just this last week went down with another friend to go to the Lower East Side to look at new galleries, to just, you know, go check things out on, on an afternoon.
Yeah.
And said he had a list out, he printed out a list of all the ones he wanted to hit. The first four on the list closed, gone. Yeah. Like permanently closed.
I think a lot of it has to do with.
So after four, he was like, "Well, fuck it, I just have to go up to Chelsea," and then you know, went up there, and there are galleries that have closed up there. So
yeah,
I mean, things are, you know, to say the least, slightly tenuous.
Yeah,
starting a new gallery. What are you guys' feelings about that?
Well, I think, you know, right now is the perfect time to start something. I mean, I think if you've had something that's on the new side since before August of 2008, then you're probably in trouble if you had just started before then, because the rents were high. There weren't openings in the storefronts, and I know for a fact I was reading somewhere in. And a lot of those Lower East Side galleries, which there are a lot that are still there, like Lisa Cooley, Invisible Exports, Small A, and they're great galleries, and I don't think they're going anywhere. But a lot of those guys wound up in situations, because I used to work for the Lower East Side Business Improvement District, and the rents for those retail spaces were $7,500 a month. And if you can think about that, and then on top of the recession hitting, you know, it really puts people in a bind, and it definitely hurts their ability to show what they want. And there's only so much commercial stuff that you can show and sell. So I think on top of that, and then when the auction prices started going down, I think people just, they had too much money invested in these leases and too much capital tied up that they weren't able to respond. And so now, starting a gallery is perfect now, because you walk around Soho and it's almost like the 90s again, where I feel like when I was a younger kid and I would come to New York, where there's still a little bit rough feeling because there's so many stores. I mean, you go to the Drawing Center in Worcester and there's like four or five storefronts open, you know, and nobody's been there for a year. Right next there's that church, and then it's all empty, and then it's the Drawing Center.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's the perfect time, because there's a space that's available, and you can make deals with landlords, and you can do the shows that you want.
Yeah, it's sort of like the early or mid 90s. I remember Kenny Schachter was doing these kind of salon shows in random spaces, and in a way, I mean, I thought those were some of the most exciting shows that were going on at that particular time, and. So I've been in this for a little while, so I've seen and experienced, you know, these kind of major recessions, and I think it's a time to try new things, try different things, and I think Ari's going to focus mainly on on some of the fairs, you know, and then you were thinking about maybe. Approaching doing maybe some shows here or.
Yeah, I mean one of the things I want to focus on is ad hoc shows. I mean, I did a fair amount of traveling in 2005 through 2007 when I was out of college, and one of the great things is, you know, I worked with Steven in 2007 in February. We worked together at a show called Emergency Room. By Thierry Geoffroy at PS1, the Contemporary Space in Queens. And after that, Thierry approached me to come to the Venice Biennale. And I had never really been to Europe alone, completely alone, with nobody. And I went with him, and I went from there. And, you know, we worked at the Venice Biennale, the oldest biannual art, not fair, but what would you...
Presentation,
yeah. And so from there, I was able to go all across Europe. And one of the things that really made an impression on my mind is that with globalization and sort of the central, the European Union, it really allows you to go and do shows in Europe without much of a problem. So it's very much available. Europe is sort of as easy as to do a show in Los Angeles. And that's one of the things I like to focus, to do shows in Berlin, to do shows in London, and to do shows in Paris. And to be able to do that, you can't, you know, make a commitment to a space in New York. And that's sort of the thing I would like to focus on.
What, so. Tell me a little bit about the book that you just showed me. Because you guys were talking about Emergency Room, Stephen.
Yeah.
And Ari, you worked on it as well.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about this book.
Well, this book came out of the Emergency Room show, and Terry and I were talking about doing... Terry's the organizer of the Emergency Room, and we were talking about doing a larger book of the participating artists, because it was an international group show. And it just seemed like it was just too huge of a project, because you're making, the idea is you're making work on a 24-hour period, on an almost a news cycle, an artist responding to events or news stories, and essentially really expressing their ideas about you know, news and events. And I thought... you know, I thought it would be interesting to do a book about it. But he's always, you know, as soon as you finish a project, he wants to start another project and start another project. But I think that was a very interesting time, because it was in 2007, just before the election. It was kind of the height of the Iraq War, and there was just a lot going on. And I thought, well, so I approached him about doing a specific book about the work that I contributed to the show, and he was excited about the idea, and actually thought I already did a book about it, and I said no. So then I decided to put something together. So that's that book. And so it's part at the end of the book. There are pictures from the opening and pictures of a lot of participating artists and the public at PS1, and the book is going to be available at the PS1 bookstore. So,
and the cover is adorned now with every shade of kind of the sub-economy that has risen, every like branch of the Obama economics that arose that are still going on. That, you know, I was up on 125th Street last week,
right?
And they're still, you know, full on vendors selling Obama gear.
That's right.
You know?
It's crazy, I know. And it almost like every little fair, you see that. This, in the, like I mentioned, this was in 2007. So it was right when it was like the pre-campaign period. He had just kind of announced that he was going to run. And it just seemed like already you've kind of sensed the direction that he was going to be a sensation, he was going to be a front runner. And it didn't take much to find. So online I found all these different T-shirts that were already being designed, Obama T-shirts, and so I collected a lot of the ones I found that were kind of interesting, and I put them all in one grid and turned that into a print. So that was just one piece that I did. I wanted to do some pieces on the candidates and comment on the kind of election cycle and the kind of craziness of the 2008 election.
What do you think the craziness of today is, of 2009?
Of 2009?
Yeah, what's pulling your chain about the contemporary moment?
I mean, it's pretty amazing, actually, if you think about it. It's like, I think one of the biggest issues right out there today is just jobs, lack of jobs, you know? And it's just... It seems like it's sort of like the sort of 500-pound elephant in the room. It's like nobody's really talking about it, it seems. I mean, obviously people, I don't know, it doesn't seem to be going away. You just see like new jobs are being created, and it seems like people are so concerned about all these other things, which are important, but it's really, it's really pretty depressing in that aspect, you know. Mm. And it's like, I don't know how are we going to get these jobs back, you know? And it doesn't seem like it's really being addressed.
Well, I think, you know, those jobs will never come back. I mean, the manufacturing jobs and the blue-collar, middle-class jobs have pretty much disappeared. And, you know, it's just...
The voice of doom speaks.
it's just, you know, if you follow the trends of recessions and depressions, what happens is we go through these cycles where we're changing technology. And the way, I mean, the only thing that can really bring back, I mean, they tried the industrial war complex, and it didn't work because we no longer fight these huge battles, and now we're moving to less and less men in war, and less manufacturers are needed because we don't use those types of weapons, and now you just need one company that produces droids.
Or a drone.
Drones, sorry, drones. Droids are Star Wars.
Not too many video games.
I'm not a big sci-fi guy, but I think it's because I've seen all those commercials for the Google phone.
I just picture creepy walking M16 through the desert.
Yeah. No, but I mean, we've gone into this sort of faceless economy where, you know, most of our transactions are done on the internet and credit cards, and I think it's sort of these intangibles that exist now, and unfortunately, we've created an economy that no longer needs American workers because it's so globalized. Like, we don't
need, except in the shipping industry where, you know, UPS is booming.
Yes, because the things are coming in from overseas, but to make the object, the consumer in America is no longer needed to produce anything.
Well, they could be, obviously, with there could be. I mean, there's a lot of smart technology out there that's being developed, and there's a lot of kind of green technology in terms of. Yes. I mean, the automobile industry could be totally radically reinvented now.
Green,
but yeah.
Green technology is something that could bring back the American worker, but. We all know global warming is just a myth, so don't worry about that.
But one thing that Ari and I are always bantering back and forth about is the fact that, I mean, Obama and Bush both totally dropped the ball on giving all the money to the banks, and it's like the banks are just they're buying out weaker banks and just they're looking after themselves, and they're not giving small loans out to small businesses and stuff. So. That's not encouraging any growth, really. They're just becoming more and more consolidated and powerful.
Which is crazy to walk down the street in New York City, and you know, there are portions of the town, granted not the whole town, but portions of the town where you will see three Chase Manhattan banks within a one block radius.
And, you know, it's not just New York anymore either. It's everywhere. And that's another thing that struck me when I was traveling around. Was that the same thing that was happening on the Lower East Side was also happening in Manchester, England, where they were closing down. It was like it was weird to be in a totally different country, but yeah, they were putting luxury condominiums for people that never showed up, and they were building banks for money that people don't have, and they were closing record stores and music venues.
So these are
it's the same. Everybody is experiencing, even my own hometown. You walk down the streets in Brookline, and you have two CVS stores on one end of the corner of a block,
yeah,
a kitty corner, and then you have a bank, and then you have Verizon, and then you have Walgreens, and it's like you could be anywhere.
So these are the problems facing us right now.
Yeah.
You got joblessness. You got corporations, you know, hegemonically, you know, gobbling up blocks at a time, cities at a time. I mean, what are the answers that, you know, people,
well,
supposedly people look towards artists, the innovators, the thinkers.
But not,
what are some of the ideas that are coming that you guys have heard of?
I think, you know, it's not just the arts is intangible. We're actually, I mean, Terry, when he would get interviewed, this, you know, the artist we worked with at PS1, he would say that he makes objects. And it's true. I mean, artists, and there is a great congressman from Ohio, and he's from the the 7th district.
Great congressman. That's hard to, it's just the idea.
No, right? I don't know what I don't know what
you are pulling some.
You might want to edit that part.
No. But you know what I'm saying? It's like I don't know what skeletons he has in his closet, what mistress he has in Venezuela, or you know, like all the others, but or Argentina. You know,
he's a governor.
Yeah, but what he said, and he said something that I found. I mean, I read an article in Freeze magazine, which is a great magazine out in London. It's based in London. And this guy wrote in one of the introductory articles, he wrote, is art in America so insignificant that Bush, when he was doing his, you know, he's doing his deeds to censor the news and media stuff, he did not pay attention to art. There was nothing, artists could do whatever they wanted, and there was no of the same repercussions we saw with the NEA in the early 90s and with Andre Serrano. There was none of that. And they said, is art so insignificant about the world that it does, they, who cares what they do? But this congressman, he made an important part, an important point. And he said that artists and gallery owners, they are the small business of America. We are still very much a thriving small business. I mean, it's hard to think about it like that because, I mean, a very small minority of the population participates in the market, but it's very small business, and you know, we set up our shingle on, you know, Orchard Street or 25th Street, and there's an interaction that goes on with this regular people that was reminiscent when people owned like hardware stores and. You know, it was sort of like the last man standing.
You can say that.
Yeah.
And which I agree to some extent.
Yeah.
But, I mean, on the flip side of that, you have your David Zwerners, your Larry Gagosians.
Sure.
Your people like that who cater not to your mom and pop retailers and people coming in and learning your name and selling your products, right?
Right.
But they cater to the very richest of the richest of the richest.
But even
people
them,
in the world buying right. the very most precious rare things in the world.
True.
But so that is not an egalitarian business setup for small business owners.
But the idea is that there's still a very small business of perhaps 20 people, 25 people.
Sure, for a small, you know, small, gallery.
Right.
Yes. But I mean, it's not
egalitarian.
It's not a people's, you know, adventure.
But anybody can walk into Gagosian and see the wares that he's selling.
True.
And in that sense, you know, it's very much. And there's, I think, you know, there's barriers that have been erected by, I don't know why these barriers have been erected around the institution of art. It can be made by everybody. And there's nothing stopping people from making art. It's just this concept or around people who are not involved with art. I don't understand why we have distanced ourselves from mainstream America.
Right. Well, I think what Zephyr is referring to is a lot of these galleries have been dependent on these hedge fund, you know, collectors who basically collect art to write off. It's a tax write off for them, you know. And now a lot of those guys are in a lot, you know, they're in trouble. So it's, I mean, that's
But that's nothing new for art.
Right, you know? Right. I know that's an old thing. But a lot of them are you know, it's a difficult economy, and just a couple of years ago, I think there was a lot of sort of crazy collecting going out there. There was not necessarily, maybe a lot of these people weren't particularly really informed or interested in art, but it was more of just simply a business transaction. I mean, I think of art as more of an exchange of ideas and
of course.
And I don't think of it as a, I mean, when you just talk about, you know, art in general, but
that's why you're the artist.
Yeah, well, yeah, I don't think of it as I didn't do this to be like to be a small business or something, you know, but I see Ari's point though. It's that some politicians and leaders have have really suppressed art, suppressed ideas, and they're just interested in big business. And I guess if you know.
We were discussing about art is a small business, and what was the last comment?
Well, we can kind of move on from there.
Yeah.
Art is a small business in America. You know, it's definitely one model that people have been looking at more recently to give some validity towards art. The other is large scale art, public art projects. You know, something such as not necessarily my favorite, but the cows or the hearts that cities put forward, large scale public art projects to bring. Art to the attention of people in America, because it's definitely with public schools slashing art programs first. I mean, there are many public schools in America right now that have no art department at all, and so these things disappearing from American culture, many people are wondering, how the hell do you bring that back? You know what I mean?
I think if I weigh in here. I think that the slashing art has to do a lot with the quantification of education, and how all of a sudden now we have all these standardized tests, and I feel that we moved into this even in baseball. I mean, if you're interested in baseball at all, and you see now the saber metrics and all that stuff started by Bill James, who now works for the Boston Red Sox. It's the turning everything into numbers, and I feel as though in education we've lost the concept of what it means just to think, to create an idea and to exchange that idea with another person, which is all that art is, in my opinion. And because of that, I feel like they feel that it's okay to slash art, because that type of critical thinking is no longer needed. And a big way that they go after those funds is, I feel that the politicians, what they do is they turn art into this frivolous sort of ivory tower preoccupation. And so because it's not needed and it's just for rich people, we can slash it and divert those funds to something else. And, I think a big way of getting art back into education is to revert the education system to a system that prizes critical thought over just a recitation of facts, like George Washington, and history is important, but really what we should be teaching our kids is ideas and how to transmit those ideas to others.
Well, many would argue, Stephen, maybe you can respond to this, many would argue that capitalism doesn't favor that kind of multifaceted thinking. That capitalism favors the number, favors the statistic, and will cut everything clean down to the bone. And so that as long as we embrace this economic system, this living system, this social system as well, capitalism, that there's no possibility for getting back to kind of more idea thinking.
Well, we're at it at a time where we need ideas, and it's incredible what's happened to several different industries in America, and particularly the auto industry, and it's that auto industry really failed miserably
to the
American. Yeah, it churned out these
hundreds of years ago.
It skirted environmental issues that were addressed in the 90s by Gore, and then it addressed created the SUV, and it's based on fear in a sense. They want America to buy these bigger cars, and somehow if you have a bigger car you're safer in that car, and it doesn't address any environmental issues. It doesn't address any energy efficient issues and stuff. So, but we're at a time where you have to create something new, this critical thinking is really, really is needed in the institutions and education institutions, and it should be something that really should change.
No, capitalism is dependent on ideas, And you can see that with copyright law. And copyright law is an intrinsic part of capitalism and how it exists, because it allows you to capitalize an idea. So we are really just shooting ourselves in the foot by cutting out these art programs, because what we're creating is we're creating middle management people who can just crunch numbers. And unfortunately, we've also created, with outsourcing, the ability to, instead of paying our number crunchers $50,000, we can pay India's number crunchers $10,000. So even though we're creating all these universities, and oddly enough, even with these quantification tests, universities have never been so popular. You know, and we have universities shooting up everywhere, colleges, everybody's going to college, master's degrees and everything, but nobody has jobs, because those jobs that they are trained for are done by overseas in Poland or in India or Pakistan, and those jobs can be done at a fraction of the cost.
So, I mean, is that the new art market then too? Is that where we should be heading for the new art?
I mean, there are a ton of collectors down there.
It might appear that art in America is in fact dead. And no, that the new thing is happening in India. The new thing is happening in Poland.
I mean, I think, you know, art is always alive everywhere. It's just a matter of the attention that you pay to it. I mean, it's not as if India has never been creating art. You know, I mean, I can't rattle off of Indian artists, but you know for a fact that this, for thousands of years, the culture has existed. You know, and I think, you know, art in America is not dead. It's changed into something else. And
is it this bloated, you know, Nero-esque Caligula corpse just, you know, feeding off mass corpulence?
Perhaps it was, but, you know, that is the beauty of the recession, is that it trims the fat. And so, you know, it allows the market was, I mean, to use like a business term, the market was overheated. And people kept pushing and pushing and pushing. And what has happened is it went to its height and it has fallen back down. And now is the time when people are saying, you know, bigger is not better. And the real ideas can come forth and we can have an honest discussion, because there isn't that pressure to sell. And so I think that's the natural part of the economy, is that, you know, ups and downs.
Right, and there's also this argument that actually this is a really great time to be making art, because it isn't about the money as so much. It's not so much about this is a really interesting time with changes to be making art, because the art is reflecting these changes, and it's about this particular time in this moment.
Now, I want your guys' opinion on this. This is an issue that directly relates to both of you and what we're talking about. You know, traveling around the world, as both of you have done, and traveling around the United States as well, one of the things that I've seen is a stronger art community in other towns, fostered by the fact that artists there don't have to work as hard to live in a city, that their rent is cheaper, that there tend to be, cheaper places not only to, you know, live, but also to eat, and cheaper things to do than New York City.
Mm-hmm.
In that New York City is, in fact, pushing its artists out that way, and is you know, creating this weird culture vacuum where it calls in the tourists of the world and says it is the art capital of the universe. You know, come to us. Mm-hmm. Come see this thriving beast, right? But in fact, underneath that is pushing all the real artists that are making work today, not the dead ones, you know, populating MoMA and things like that, but the people actually making things today.
Jackson Pollock lives in Queens.
Yeah. So what do you guys think about that scenario that's happening in the United States right now and across the world? That New York is actually just this kind of weird facade without an actual art community in it.
Right. I think this has been going on for quite some time. I mean, New York has been expensive for seems like for ages. But in a way, it's a really New York is also it is a tough place for artists, but it's also a challenging place for artists, because I mean, literally, you can find artists. Some really, really great artists from all over the world showing in the few 50, 60 galleries that are here, better galleries that are here. And in some sense, it does draw a lot of really interesting work, but at the same time, it makes it a lot more competitive. And I came from San Francisco, and coming from San Francisco, I felt that there was a really, in terms of the artists that I work with, and I went to the San Francisco Art Institute, they, it was more of a community there. And often if a German curator came in or a German collector came in, I would get a phone call from another artist and said, look, I just sent over a German curator or a collector over to your studio. And it was, you know, it didn't happen very often, but when it did, people travel around, they knew each other, and they were very supportive. And when I came to New York, it was a completely opposite experience. And even some of the artists that had moved from San Francisco to here, that I even saw that they started to behave a little differently too, and I just noticed it was much more competitive, and people were really people were really trying to they would invite you to the studio, and then they would hope that you would probably get them a show somewhere else, or I don't know, it had a very different vibe, and it wasn't nearly as supportive.
Yeah, I think, you know, it has two faces. I think in one hand it's good because you don't think you're the, you know, the greatest artist in the world. You know, and you come to New York and you see that there's people that come from all over the world to be here. And they you know, they show you stuff that you never knew about wherever you came from, even if you grew up in New York, you know. But on the other hand, you know, it creates a little bit of this nastiness between people. I think it creates, you know, this super competitive atmosphere where if you know of a collector, you don't want to share it to somebody else because of this fear of losing it, losing the collector. But I think the best people are, you know, they can be confident, and they know that, you know, if you live above the fray, and I think it relates to everything in New York, not just art, but, you know, writing and business, and you have to sort of distance yourself from the fray, from the din of New York, and allow yourself to do your own thing, which you came here originally to do. And if you do that, then I think you're okay, and you can do it. I mean, it's just harder. I don't think it's... I mean, I know the artists are being pushed out, and for instance, 20 years ago, we'd be having this conversation on 3rd Street in Avenue A, but today we're on Mezerol in Leonard and...
We don't do that. It's a secret location.
But, you know, it's like, you know, we're in this undisclosed location in Tora Bora.
In the Batcave, Ari.
You know, and we share a barbecue pit with Osama bin Laden, but you know, it's still there. I mean... It still exists. It's still very vibrant. I think it's tougher now, but I also, there's a sense when you go back into the city, right? I mean, I never thought I would live in Brooklyn. I lived in Manhattan when I was a little kid, and I didn't even know Brooklyn really existed besides the bridge, and it sort of just ended at the bridge, you know? But if you go back into the city, there is also that sense that things are opening up, and a lot of people have left. And there's, you know, this sort of oppressiveness that all of a sudden these people came to New York to work in these finance jobs, and all of a sudden there's all these people everywhere you went. You couldn't, like, you know, I love going to these small restaurants, and all of a sudden, you know, one would open up and it would be empty and it would be perfect, which I guess is probably bad for the restaurateur, but amazing for you, and, you know, you got this great atmosphere, and it's like in your living room. And then the next moment there'd be like 100 people. Like, I saw this one... I lived in the Lower East Side, and I saw in the span of a year this one brunch place, the Clinton Street Baking Company, go from a place where you could wait 20 minutes to a place where it would take 2.5 hours to get a table, which is insane. I mean, you could go shopping and just buy the brunch yourself and save $20, whatever.
Yeah. But going back to your point about the art, I work a lot in London as well, and in London is also very expensive. And my artist friends over there, they I mean, they have really kind of creative ways of living. Several of them have converted a pub, which has previously had hotel rooms above it, into basically just, it's just a whole building full of artists, and it's subdivided, and they live relatively cheaply over there. It's like $300 a month or something for each room. And everybody travels by bicycle, you know, and if we're in the East End, we only go and, like, when we get beers and stuff, it's like they get street beers. They don't even go to pubs. So they go to the pubs and they get street beers there, and they don't even buy beer out of the pubs and stuff, you know. But these guys just graduated from the Royal Academy and the Royal College, you know, and they're living like that. And they're doing some amazing work, and they're actually also working in kind of essentially, I mean, pretty industrial sort of lofts, banded loft spaces where their studios are. So they went from the Royal College, Royal Academy to these really abandoned spaces. And so, I mean, artists just adapt and adjust to their circumstances. I don't think that they're making worse art because it's more expensive there. I just think that they live in, they don't live as comfortably as other artists perhaps do in more affordable areas.
And it's the same thing with galleries. I feel like you just have to be a little bit smarter. You have to be a little bit tougher. And, you know, there's not that empty warehouse that you can just squat and turn into a gallery, but there is the Small Business Association in New York. And there's plenty of opportunities because ever since September 11th, companies moved out of their major corporate offices. A lot of companies downtown in the World Trade Center area, in Tribeca, there's a lot of empty commercial space that you can take advantage of. And for one thing, it's called Swing Space, is the Lower Manhattan project, where they will work with you and to fill these spaces so that they're not just left abandoned and sort of desolate. So I think there's still plenty of opportunity to put on shows and to show good work in the same area. It's just a little bit harder, and you have to, you know, work with more bureaucratic people, and so that's sort of a drag sometimes. But it's not impossible. Art is very much alive, and, you know, I mean,
in the big city,
probably the music scene is far worse off than the art scene, for sure.
Right.
I think the live venues are disappearing. That's a shame.
And that is a conversation for another day.
Sure.
Thank you both so very much. My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle. Perhaps you're listening at artonair.org. That's Art International Radio. Or perhaps frankprattle.com. My guests today, Stephen Day, the artist who is going to be the vanguard of vinyl contemporary down in Miami for the Verge Art Fair, and Ari Jankelowitz.
Jankelowitz.
Who I swear I will one day, upon years of knowing you, perhaps when we're old men with gray hair, we will say each other's names correctly. Thank you both so much.
Thank you
very much, Stephanie.